All right, Dad, finish this sentence. A Martinsville hot dog is like...
Oh, I guess an orgasm.
Hold on to your butts. It's the MastCast.
On this week's episode of the MastCast, we talk all things Martinsville, including hot dogs, fond memories, snowed out races, and Boyer's big win. We talk about reviving short track racing at the local and national level. We have a humorous quote of the week, and we even managed to sneak in some baseball talk as well. Well, Martinsville, whether it was on time on Sunday or had to wait a day because of the stupid snow, Martinsville is always awesome, in my opinion. The race was awesome. It just felt good for me when I turned the race on, just see, because I had to work a little bit because it was Monday, so I didn't get to see the very beginning, but when I came home, turned it on, and man, it just felt good. It just always feels good to see NASCAR at a short track, first of all. What'd you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you always look forward to Martinsville. It's just kind of like Richmond, you know, and Bristol. You look forward to those things. And, you know what I liked about it, Ricky? Well, it was cool. I mean, we had a lot of fun on Twitter Sunday night. All the guys, all the drivers Twittering about their antics in the snow. It was Stenhouse and, I think it was Kyle Larson. I guess they were trying to watch some motorcycle race or something, and the snow got on their dishes, so they had to climb on top of the motorhomes and clean the dish. I saw a picture of Stenhouse, and he looked like some kind of running pants or something in cowboy boots, climbing up an aluminum ladder to the top of his $1 million motorhome to scrape the snow off. And then the drivers had a running dialogue about that. But it was a lot of fun. I'll tell you something else I learned. Have you ever heard of a snow sucker?
I had not. And speaking of Stenhouse, he and Blaney were riding in the snow sucker, weren't they?
I think they were, but I had never, ever never even heard of a snow sucker, but they said they drove a thing in from Indiana. I guess the same company provides that sweeper each week for the tracks. Had one of those dudes, and that thing was pretty cool. Somebody asked me the question, well, once they suck it up, what do they do with the snow? And I'm like, you know, don't take it that far. Just enjoy the fact that there is such a thing as a snow sucker at Martinsville, sucking the snow away right now from the track. But it was a mess. Sunday, it was a mess. I mean, they had the track pretty good, but there's no way you could have had that event because if anybody knows about Martinsville and where you park there, it's a lot of hills, a lot of grass, a lot of dirt, and you're slip and slide a lot. So they did a good job making that thing Monday. And surprised me the number of people that actually showed up for the race on Mondays, because a lot of time Mondays, man, it's hard to get people in there. But the track, I saw where Clay Campbell offered a deal. If you had a truck ticket for the truck race or a cup ticket for the cup race, you could come in and watch both races on Monday. So that was a cool deal.
Yeah, it was. And Clay is another he's another good one out there. Like our buddy Dennis at Richmond, he's just a good guy, good promoter, I mean, and you want to see him do well.
Well, yeah, I mean he's from the old school. I mean he was taught by his granddad, you know, the famous Clay Earls, and Clay Earls one of the greatest promoters ever of racetracks or racing. And, you know, that boy was brought up around that. So he gets it. He understands it.
You know what? I just thought of this. I didn't realize the last time a NASCAR race had been canceled or postponed, I should say, because of snow was Atlanta in 93, I guess it was. And that's when you were full time in the Cup Series. What do you remember about that whole deal?
I remember the best thing about it. Richard Jackson, who I drove for, he Richard had a thing. He always, you know, all those years I raced with Richard, his one thing was he didn't stay in crappy motels. So wherever we went, he always had the crew guys in some of the best motels, you know, that was right near the racetrack. And that particular race, we were at a nice motel in the southern end of Atlanta. I forget the name of it. It was real swanky, nice motel. Well, When the thing got snowed out, that was before I had an airplane or any of that, and we had flown down there commercial, and by the time the thing was snowed out or whatever, the airport was shut down, so we couldn't get home. So anyhow, we were stuck in the motel. I think it was like 3 days before we could get out of there. But I'm going to tell you something, Ricky. We ate high on the hog, man. We ate, you know, because Richard paid for our meals when we were there. So, you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner was always filet mignon, lobster, or whatever. The problem is the third day they started running out of food. And that's when I started getting concerned. So what we did, we kept looking and looking and looking. Finally, we got a flight out of Atlanta. They finally let us out of there, and we got to Charlotte. But we couldn't get from Charlotte back to Roanoke, which is where our rental car, our car was. So we finally got to Charlotte. Couldn't get back home from there. Rented a car and drove up Interstate 77 to 81. Well, when we came through the top of the mountain on Interstate 77, and the people in Virginia know about this area, it was the snow on the interstate was terrible. And we were getting through there, and people were wrecked everywhere, and I was kind of crawling through this mess. About the time we hit 81, we heard on the radio Interstate 77 was shut down. That thing shut down that evening and was shut down for like 24 hours to the next day. So we were basically 30 minutes on Interstate 77 getting through there before we was going to have to stay in somebody's house or a high school or whatever it was. So, but finally we got home.
Well, two things. First of all, I-77 now for me, especially when I come home to visit y'all in Virginia and when I take I-77 through Charlotte, it doesn't need snow or anything for you to be stuck there for a better part of a day. So I can't imagine trying to deal with that in the snow. But more importantly, and I'm about to veer this whole conversation way off topic, but you just said something there that I need to point out to all the faithful MathCast listeners out there. This goes back a few years. One time I asked what was for dinner, and you said that, I believe the quote was, "Don't nobody call it dinner. Only wussies call it dinner. It's supper. It's supper." Just a minute ago, I just heard you say breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I just heard you say that, and I want to point that out publicly, that you just called it dinner.
Well, I've been thinking about it a lot since you told me that, Rick, but I'm going to tell you something. I've been reading about this a little bit and watching. A lot of people I see still call it supper. In fact, somebody here a week or two ago on something I read was complaining about that. They said, when did the time I was born and raised and all through the years, I always ate supper. When did supper become dinner? And I have to agree with him. Dinner is something like for yuppies or a finer class of people. Is that a way to say it?
Yeah. You know what? I just realized I got the quote wrong. It wasn't wussy. It was yuppie. You said yuppie. Yuppies would say that.
I guess it's the way you're raised. I mean, it was always supper. Who the hell decided it was dinner? It's not dinner. It's supper.
Well, I know a guy.
I'm gonna stick to that till the day I die.
That's fair. I know a guy. Well, you know him too, who refers to what we call lunch as dinner time. Not even dinner. He just says around dinner time. And he's a good old boy construction worker, and he calls lunch dinner time. I don't know where that's the only place I've ever heard that. Have you ever heard that?
Before? No, I've never heard that. Okay. I never even heard of this dinner crap everybody uses till just a few years ago. It was always supper.
I think you can use either one.
But well, you know what that really is? It's like, what's the movie, Smokey and the Bandit? It's like when
I know what you're going to say. The
Burt Reynolds guy was talking to the Sally Fields guy, and they were talking about intelligence.
Yeah.
And Burt Reynolds says intelligence is really what part of, or something like along
it's,
the lines of.
It's, I'll tell you what it is. I don't remember exactly what it was either, but it's basically like, it depends on where you're, what part of the country you're standing in as to how dumb you are, basically.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Because I think he asked her, he said, "You ever heard of Waylon Jennings?" She said, "No." "You ever heard of Richard Petty?" "No." "Well, that doesn't mean she's not intelligent." "Well, yeah, it is really." So,
yeah. And then she asked him, "Do you like Elton John?"
And he goes, "Who?"
Yeah. And he basically didn't. Although for us, I think Elton John's kind of, that's not normally somebody either you or I would like, I guess, based on a lot of our other musical tastes. But I don't know. I like Elton John. I'm pretty sure you do too. So
I love Elton John, man. Rocket Man. Y'all, the family gave me birthday tickets to one of his shows in Roanoke here a few years ago. I don't care. I love good musicians. Mm-hmm. If you're a guitar player or whatever you do, or singer or composer, if it's good music, I love it.
Do you know Elton John is a big Atlanta Braves fan? Believe it or
not. I do know. I have heard he's a Braves fan.
Yeah, we got, we're all, everybody's all abuzz down here in Atlanta. Of course, I work in baseball with the Braves. And tomorrow, as we're sitting here recording this, tomorrow is the national holiday of all days for baseball fans. It's opening day, so we're pretty pumped and excited about it. I'm just going to go ahead and straight up plug Braves and baseball here on our NASCAR podcast. It's just a shameless plug by me.
Hey, I want to tell you something, Bray. Back in the day when I was racing the Braves, man, they were big. A lot of those players are big-time fans. I remember, oh, gosh, what's the dude's name that won the World Series? The Royals? Was it the Royals?
Oh, you're talking about Ned Yost. Yeah, he's the manager of the Royals now.
I met him. He came up and introduced himself one time in the early 90s. I think we were at Charlotte. And we got talking a lot. He said, I'll tell you, Rick. He says, you know, a lot of the Braves players are Rick Mass fans. I said, well, that's cool, dude. Then I think we set them up. We set that clubhouse up on the Skol deal. In other words, you know, once every couple of weeks, they get a case of Skol for the clubhouse. So it was a good connection.
That's a pretty solid deal. Well, yeah, Ned Yost still, he currently manages the Royals. He wears his uniform number is number 3 because he was very good buddies with Dale Earnhardt Sr. And he's worn number 3 in honor of Dale Sr. Still does all these years later. Yeah, so
that is correct. That is correct. They made a big deal of that when he won the World Series. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah. You know, one time when you were down here in Atlanta, you met Terry Pendleton, who was 91 MVP for the Braves. Longtime player, even longer time. He's been a coach with the Braves for a long time, and he still works with the front office now. I was walking in SunTrust Park the other day. There's this one hallway in this one area of the stadium where they got a bunch of random kind of baseball cards of Braves players throughout all the years that are blown up and printed out on the wall. It's a really cool hallway. As me, as a nerd that collects stuff like that. I was looking, was walking through that hallway the other day, was kind of checking out the cards, and I realized there was one there, and I was like, why does that card stick out to me so much? And I realized when you met Terry Pendleton one time in Atlanta at the racetrack back, because Terry's a big NASCAR fan also, you met him, you got him to sign me some baseball cards, and that it's that card. It's a few copies of that card that I still have in a folder in a safe here. That's signed by Terry Pendleton that he signed at a NASCAR track. And now that card is one of the ones that they've reproduced and is hanging up in the ballpark. So it's all full circle here somehow.
It's full circle. I've still got Terry. He signed a hat for me. I've got the trophy room actually still.
That's right. It's a Skol Classic Racing hat, isn't it?
Skol Classic Racing by Terry Pendleton. Yep.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Well, back to our lunch, supper, dinner thing real quick. You could eat a Martinsville hot dog at any of those meals, couldn't you? I mean, point.
Well, here's the deal. You remember maybe a few years ago, AmeriCrown, which is the division of NASCAR, they do food services and some other things. They decided they'd take over the food service at Martinsville. When they did, they took away the famous hot dog. Well, for those of you who remember, I forget how long it's been, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago. This thing went so bad. By Saturday afternoon, Mike Hilton held a press conference and explain to everybody, listen, tomorrow we're bringing back, the racetrack is bringing back the Martinsville hot dog. They got chastised and criticized. It was the damnedest thing I ever seen. It was like a revolt in the garage area because they changed the hot dog. So anyhow, after that, it died down a little bit. They decided to bring back the Martinsville original hot dog. Well, the first time I went down there after they did that, I took one bite of that dude. I'm like, this is not the original Martinsville hot dog, but I kept it to myself. You know, I would eat them, but not I didn't consume them the way I used to because it just wasn't the same. Well, if you notice, if people caught this, when was it? A month ago or whatever, they announced we're bringing back the original Jesse Jones hot dog, and I'm like, okay, guys, all right, you've got your act together. So that was I lived back in, we used to go down there. We have to get there for that bush race or the dogwood race. We'd be here on Thursday. We would race till Sunday. I lived on the hot dogs and Fifth Avenue bars and Pepsis. That's what they sold there.
Yeah, I went to all those Martinsville races as a kid with you, and I lived on the Martinsville hot dogs while I was there too. I remember walking up to the concession stand back when, this is how old I am, or how old I'm getting, when you go up to the concession stand and a hot dog at Martinsville was $1. And I'd just walk up there and get me, you had the one concession stand there in the middle of the infield, and whenever you even felt the least bit hungry or just... You know, the thing is, it's a short track and it's small, and you have one concession stand right there in the middle, and you'd smell those hot dogs cooking all day long, and it's just like the very first second you even felt the least little bit of hunger coming on, it's like, yep, going to get me a hot dog. Now, let me ask you this hard-hitting question here. I am, and still am, for the most part, just a plain hot dog, I don't even want anything on it guy. I just had one here at the ballpark the other day. that just plain didn't, I didn't even put ketchup, mustard, nothing on it. That's just me. How do you, if you,
no.
What is your best way to consume a Martinsville hot dog, no, or hot dog in general?
It's got to be mustard, onions, chili. And it depends. And my deviation would be to add coleslaw or not. And, you know, that was always one of my biggest decisions going to concession stand. Do I get it mustard, onions, and chili, or do I add the coleslaw? And it was kind of like, all right, you know, the mid-morning break, you would just get the regular deal. For lunchtime, you get the regular deal. But at the end of the day, you know, when you're wanting to, you know, kind of reward yourself for a hard day's work, you'd go ahead and let them put coleslaw on it. And that's kind of, it kind of ended up working out that way for me.
Okay. Coleslaw on a hot dog. I'm just so plain. I'm just a plain cheese pizza guy, plain hot dog. I just don't need cheeseburger. I just want ketchup for the most part. I just don't, I don't know. I'm just a simple guy. Simple desires. That's all.
Well, it's like it's one of your silly sisters doesn't eat bread. She'll get a roast beef sandwich from Arby's and eat the roast beef and put, she's never eaten bread from any of these fast food deals, Ricky. We lived at fast food deals.
I know.
Going to play, when those girls played all that travel ball and everything we did, we're always fast food, and you get a hamburger or a hot dog, whatever you get, she'd take the bread off of it. Damn it. I never understood that, but you know, to each their own.
She told me here with not too long ago, within the last month or so, that she ate a burger or a sandwich somewhere with a bun. And I was floored. And I don't know if it's stuck or if she's going to keep doing that. My twin sisters are 21 years old, by the way. So just let that sink in. She's just now getting to the point where she will even try a bun on a fast food sandwich. I guess less carbs. So I mean, maybe it's a healthier way to live. I don't know.
I just always thought it strange, but like it I say, to each their own.
Yeah. Well, Dad, long live the streak. The streak is over. The drought is over, I should say. Clint Bowyer finally gets his first win in the 14 car for Stuart Haas. And I think in addition to the win, I think he definitely got the early photo of the year candidate, or favorite, I should say, in NASCAR with the picture of him and his son running towards each other on the front stretch after the win. What'd you think of his win and the race in general?
Well, to start with, there's this parody account on Twitter that every day counts down how many races since Clint Bowyer's last win. And it's funny as a dickens. But anyhow, when the race ended up and it was over, I was following him and reading all that. It was real funny to watch all that. But, you know, happy for Bowyer, man. They've had trouble. I mean, he's had some trouble. I mean, he's, you know, it's been a while for the guy. Happy for Stuart Haas. You got to think about this, man. Stuart Haas. They could have won. Luck be a little bit different. They could have won every race this year. I mean, they're on top right now. They've got it going on. Pitcher of the year with him. Yeah, probably. That's probably going to end up being the pitcher of the year. Him and his boy running towards each other. That was cool. But you know, I think the bigger story of all this is where Stuart Haas is right now. And then the other thing about Bowyer, you think back last year, I think it was maybe Talladega or somewhere, middle of the race, Bowyer comes down pit road, parks his car on pit road, gets out, jumps up on pit wall, cusses a crew chief, and goes on to the motorhome lot, you know? And I remember everybody thinking, oh boy, this is not going to be good. But, you know, obviously those guys have sat down. I listened to Zipadelli, I guess, Greg, talking about that. And the guys respected each other's talents and abilities, but they weren't really friends. So it's my understanding they kind of worked on all that, and you know, they're seeing results of it now. So that was a good deal. I tell you a couple of things that was strange to me. It seemed like, and I don't know what it was, but it seemed like people weren't being very big time aggressive like they normally are at Martinsville. And I'm not sure what that was about. What do you attribute that to? The technical part of the race, the whatever tire Goodyear had there, I believe is the best tire I've ever seen at that racetrack, mainly because no rubber ever got built up. You didn't see rubber built up in the groove. You didn't see these marbles out of the groove like you always seen for 50 years at that racetrack. I'm not sure what the deal there was, but it was definitely a different tire than they've used there before, because it kept the outside groove clean most of the time, and guys could actually pass on the outside. And then, you know, you didn't see You didn't see brake fairs. You didn't see the dreaded bead melting from the hot brakes. Now that might have had something to do with the ambient air temperature being so cold. I mean, that could be that, or the guys have just gotten real good at it. I'm not sure what that was, but you know, it's hardly any wrecks. You know, not a lot of aggression, but you know, it was still a good competitive race.
Yeah, I wonder if I think that the aggression at Martinsville tends to come out in the fall race with good reason, because there's so much more on the line, and by that point you've got 30 weeks of races not under your belt, but in your memory, and all your grievances and everything else. That's they all can come out at that point, and maybe that's just subconsciously they all come in there thinking it's still early in the season, nobody's really all that pissed off at anybody just yet, and there's long way to go. You know, maybe that's just a time of the year kind of thing.
Well, the other thing too, and I mentioned this, the ambient temperature, and there's no doubt that the temperature inside the race cars or how hot a driver is, that dictates a lot of times how the drivers act. Because I go back to your granddaddy. When your granddaddy used to have a racetrack, Ricky, and used to promote it, he'd always say that he had to beef up security by the 1st of August, because 1st of August is when it would get so hot up here in Virginia. And it would be just the dog days of August. You know, it's so daggum hot. Everybody's fuses were a lot shorter, put it that way. And there would always be a bunch of fights because everybody got hot and they got miserable and they just start fighting. Well, it's just kind of the same way with a driver. You get Martinsville is a hard place, especially if it's a hot day, man, you just get wore out there. And the last 100 laps, you're just barely hanging on. Well, not barely hanging on, but you know, your tolerance for giving in this give and take sport, that tolerance goes away, and you just, instead of just checking up a little bit like you normally do, you say, oh, hell with it, you go and hit the guy. The first thing you know, everybody's wrecking everybody. So the cool temperature, I think, played a little part in it Sunday.
What did you think? I know I saw some people that were kind of wanting them to, if since the race got moved to Monday, some people were saying, what if we purposely made this a Monday night show? And then there's been some folks out there that have dangled just the idea of maybe putting some races on primetime during a weeknight, which I'm going to be honest with you, I'd at least like to see them try it once just to see how it would all work. Are you glad they just left it during the daytime, or what would you have thought if they moved it tonight?
Yeah, I am, because here's the problem with that. You're already into Monday evening. You're into Monday night. And what is that noise in the background I keep hearing here on MassCast? I keep hearing something in the background. What is that, Ricky?
I don't know. I've got I don't know if you ever saw the Austin Powers movies, but there was a character in a couple of those movies called Fat Bastard, and he was a big fat bastard. And that's who I think lives upstairs above me in my apartment, because he just stomps around most of the day. So maybe that's what you're hearing. I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know what it is, but everybody on MassCast heard it. But anyhow, what were we talking about? I forgot.
We were talking about Monday moving the possibility of moving a Monday night show.
Yeah, here's the problem with that. You've already you got the race scheduled for Sunday. You've already moved it to Monday. Everybody that could come to the race on Monday, they took off work to come to the race Monday. And I know some people that did that. I've known people my whole life that's done that. Well, they take off Monday to go to the race. Well, guess what? You run it Monday night, then you're getting into Tuesday now for these people that's got to work on Tuesday. So you really, really screwing up the fan. In my view, you're screwing up the fan for doing that. And as we always say on MassCast, the number one thing everybody in this sport has to think about is the fans and the fan experience. So for me, you know, I definitely wouldn't run the thing on Monday night. Now, if it's nothing but a TV event, you know, you don't have fans and stands to worry about, sure, Monday night, prime time, why not? Yeah, do it. But, you know, our sport's about our fans in the stands. You know, we got fans on TV, but we've got to always, you know, remind ourselves of the fans in the stands and what we got to do to take care of them. As far as the midweek deal goes, yeah, I'd be for that as long as they still had an event on Sunday. So for me, instead of taking the weekend off, we're going to have two races this week. We're going to have one Sunday, then we're going to have one Wednesday, then we're going to have another one next Sunday. From my standpoint, I don't want to miss the weekend races.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. And that's something I've been wanting to talk to you about. You see this all the time. You see it on Twitter, wherever. And this is certainly the way I feel too. you know, I mentioned at the top of the show how good it just felt to turn on a NASCAR race and see it at a short track. It always does. I want to see more short tracks. I want to see more short tracks. That's where the sport came from, and that's, I think that's when it's at its best for the most part, is short tracks. Now, I know that's a lot easier said than done. I mean, you can't just all of a sudden up and move, take away 10 dates from these other places and move them to little tracks, and then you got to upgrade facilities and all that. But I really think that that's something, at least we ought to try one here and there. I think we start with, why don't we start with, say, the All-Star race, right? Instead of it's Charlotte, you move it to, I don't know, off the top of my head, Hickory or South Boston or somewhere like that. Just try it. And I know that's going to cost you some money in facility upgrades, but I think that it would totally be worth it in the end. What are your thoughts on trying to integrate more short tracks and how you go about that and where you would go? I mean, just what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you could do that. It'd make for great TV deal. It'd make for great TV racing, but is that your neighbor again making that noise, Ricky, upstairs? That doesn't sound like a neighbor upstairs. That sounds like you jostling a cup around or something.
Oh, yeah, you did catch me. I thought I'd cut my mic off, but yeah, that was me. I didn't cut it off.
You keep messing with MassCast. It makes it sound not very professional.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry. Well, I won't jostle my cup around.
What's in the cup? You got spirits in the cup?
No, it's just ice water here in my Virginia football cup. It's a little worn down, but it's still hanging in there. It's just water. I promise you. I got to work early in the morning. It's just water.
Put it off the side.
It's off. It's gone.
It's irritating me.
Okay.
And again, I've lost my train of thought.
It is. Your train of thought was running more short tracks and how do you integrate it and all that good stuff.
Yeah, more short tracks make for great TV. The problem is doing it the right track. You couldn't do it at a Hickory or a South Boston because you don't have enough seating for the number of fans that need to go to that event to make the event worthwhile or functional for the whole deal to happen. You know, there's a NASCAR, there's a sanctioning fee that a track has to pay to have these events, and it's not cheap, okay? The track has to do that. Now, with that said, the track shares in the TV money and all that, but, you know, I think what really brought all this to light or what really started this conversation is when they started running the truck series at Eldora, and, you know, the place is sold out and packed and is a well-attended event and well-publicized event. The problem is, what do they have? 20,000 people, you know? So in order to get 50,000, you got to put up temporary stands for 50,000 people or whatever. So, you know, that's your first challenge, your first problem. And then, you know, you're going to add an event. You know, that means you've got to take an event away from somebody because nobody wants to add any more races. The people talking about shortening the season up a little bit, which I think is wrong, along with shortening the races. I think they all should be 500-mile races. And, instead of 400 or 300 or whatever. I just think that that's one of my beliefs. So, you know, a lot of problems for that to make it happen, but yeah, I think it would be cool.
All right. Well, if you could pick one short track to add to start off with, just one, is there one off the top of your head that comes to mind?
Man.
That's
no.
Tough.
Because, yeah. There's so many, Ricky. There's so many good Saturday night racetracks. I mean, from the East Coast to the West Coast. And this goes back to watching old Thursday Night Thunder and when the truck series first started in the 90s and they'd run all these little obscure racetracks everywhere. I'm like, man, there's just hundreds and hundreds of neat short tracks across this country that would be cool. You know, there's not one that stands out right now.
One thing I think about a lot when this discussion comes up is when the truck series first made its debut in the mid-90s, I thought one of the things that was so cool about that series was they would go to all these places that the other two big series didn't go to. They go to all these little short tracks all across the country, and it was set up different. I think at that time, I don't even think you had like live pit stops. I think you just had a couple intermissions. Like if it was a 300-lap, 300-mile race, you had like the intermission, the 100 lap mark and one at the 200 lap mark, where the guys would go in, they'd work on their trucks or whatever they had to do then. And then you go back out and start the race up again. But I just thought that, I guess where I'm getting with this is I would kind of like to see them turn maybe the Truck Series or maybe the Xfinity Series. That might even be better. If it's at all possible, I'd like kind of like to see them turn one of those big national touring series back into a, like an old Busch Grand National Series or the original Truck Series where they go to all these little tracks and it makes it something kind of different from the big product. I don't know if that's feasible either. Probably not. I know there's a lot of contracts and all this other stuff, but I would really like to see that happen.
They can make it work. I mean, that you think back, the Truck Series started exactly the way the Busch Series started. We'd run up and down the East Coast on these Saturday night bull rings. And, you know, a lot of times there wouldn't be TV. And finally, we started getting telecast on a lot of them. And, when the Truck Series started, it did the same thing. Well, what happened to the Busch Series? We'd run all those little racetracks and all through the 80s up through the early 90s. And we'd run a lot of companion events with the cup races. Somewhere through the 90s and early 2000s, it morphed into mainly becoming a companion race with the Cup Series. Well, by the time the Truck Series started, you know, the Busch Series was getting away from some of those other short tracks that we lived on or grew up with. The Truck Series did that. I mean, they did the exact same thing the Busch Series did in the early 80s. Would darn if they didn't over time morph into the same thing the Busch Series did, or Xfinity now, and that's been companion races for the most part. And this goes back to one of our digs on MassCast, and that is taking care of the short tracks across this country, you know, that really make up the base of our fan, or that's really our fan base, taking care of those people. And we're not, that's another area that we're not taking care of our fan base, and that's having some of these one of the series running all these little short tracks across the country. I think it would be great. I'm not sure how you do it, you know, sponsor wise, TV wise, all that, but I think fan wise, it would be great.
Yeah. And I'll tell you something. And one thing that people like to harp on or criticize is, you know, when you have the Xfinity Series as a companion event and they say it's boring or they just don't like it, that somebody like Kyle Busch or whoever comes down and dominates or whatever. And I get that, but think of it this way. If you move, let's say that Xfinity event gets moved to a short track somewhere that's not too terribly far away, that's reachable with a reasonable plane ride, that's on the Saturday night or wherever at a short track somewhere, suddenly if Kyle Busch is flying in to race the Xfinity regulars at a, I don't know, again, let's just say South Boston or wherever, well, even if he dominates, to me, that becomes much more interesting because you're seeing the Cup guys compete against the Xfinity guys at a different venue, at a different style track. To me, that then makes that more interesting. I don't know if I'm right about that.
No, you're
but to
exactly.
me, that's what I'm saying. Back in the Busch Grand National days, you guys would run some companion events, but it's, you know, for like an Orange County or Pulaski or what was also Pulaski County, a.k.a. New River Speedway, a.k.a. Motor Mile Speedway. It wasn't out of the question or uncommon for some of those Cup guys to come there and run the Busch Series race. And that to me, makes the whole thing a whole heck of a lot more interesting.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I guess it was 89 when I was running Busch, and I drove for Travis Carter a few races to start the year out, and we did real well. Well, I was running my Busch Series full time. And the first time this happened, right early in the season, we were racing at Richmond. Well, I had a Busch race at Hickory on Saturday night and the Cup race on Sunday at Richmond. Well, I remember me and Dale Earnhardt Sr. and Harry Gant flew in Richard Childress's car, We flew in his King Airs airplane. He flew us to Hickory. We ran the race at Hickory Saturday night. Hopped back in Richard's plane, and we flew back to Richmond Saturday night and ran the race on Sunday. But it was a cool deal on the Hickory Saturday night because there was Dale Earnhardt and Harry Gant, stars, running the Hickory Busch Grand National race in their cars or whatever, and they were, you know, competitive or whatnot. But that went on a bunch. That went on a whole lot. It wasn't a companion event, but you'd be somewhere and you'd hop on a plane and you'd fly that race, or you'd fly on a plane and run that race and get on the plane and run back for the Sunday race. And again, that goes back to the fan experience, the short track, hardcore base NASCAR fan, that things that we used to do that we do not do any longer. And there's a lot of areas that we're missing out.
Yeah, I think that when we talk about problems or issues or things with NASCAR, whatever you want to say, I mean, I think that the biggest thing that really needs to be fixed isn't so much the big sport itself as it is the local tracks. I mean, there's a lot of these tracks are down. I just mentioned the Pulaski, aka New River, aka Motor Mile. I don't know if I'm right about this, but I'd heard that it's shut down for this season. Is that correct?
It did, and that's
a shame. What a great track, and that place. It wasn't even all that long ago. That place was pretty darn vibrant. That's a shame to see if a place like that is shutting down. Then something's wrong. That's where I think the real problem. That's where I think the real problem solving needs to happen is at the local level, not so much at the top.
Yeah, I mean, the top is what it is. The top, the Cup Series is secure now for a number of years because of the TV package, the racing, everything they're going through, everything that everybody bitches about, the rules changes, and everything that everybody's fussing about. Yeah, some of it has a little bit of validity, and I get that. But NASCAR works hard trying to get these cars again back close to side by side to make the competition great or make the competition good. The drivers are doing the same thing they were doing in the 50s, 70s, 90s. They're still pushing the car to the edge, you know, doing the best they can do to make as fast a lap as they can and race everybody as hard as they can. That part hasn't changed. That you know, and NASCAR will continue to try to make rule changes and things to make it more competitive or better or whatever. That's fine. I'm 100% for all that stuff because they need to be tweaking that thing at all times, it seems like nowadays. But, you know, this short track fan base deal across our country has just been, in my mind, has just been forgotten. You think back about all the things that we used to do. You know, we talked about it a week or two ago on MassCast, doing, you know, we'd go to these Saturday night racetracks, you know, somewhere close to a Cup event and do autographs and all the deal. And the people are just in love with it. And they would end up going back home that Saturday night and then driving to the Cup race on Sunday. And they were excited about it, you know. And we did that with the Busch Series, the Truck Series, the Cup guys would come back, like we just said. A whole lot of things that went on that we do not do any longer. And when you have a track like the Motor Mile closing down, we've got problems. Another track, was it Colburn or Kingsport? Understood wasn't going to run this year. A mainstay in our sport for years, you know, and we can't let that happen. We've got to address that, you know. And here's the thing, a track like Bowman Gray Stadium with its history, you know, just a little flat football field racetrack, they pack that place every Saturday night, Ricky. So it can be done. It can be done. And I just think we need to address it somehow or another.
Yeah, I think, well, the good news is that it's not just us that are talking about that. I think that discussion is a lot of prominent people in the sport are discussing that and bringing that to light now. I know Dale Jr. is a big champion of all that. And so the good news is if we're all talking about it, then hopefully that means we're going to start coming up with some solutions for it soon. Let's hope.
Yeah, well, yeah, you can, but somebody has to make that decision. You know, somebody's got to make the decision and make the points and make the and a financial, it's got to be a financial thing too. You know, somebody has to step up to the plate for that because some of these things cost money. But, you know, I think the direction of these guys, they need to look at that, and hopefully they will. We bitch about it on MassCast enough each week. They'll take notice. Enough of those guys in prominent power listen to MassCast. So there is your chance, guys. We're telling you what to do. Now go fix it.
Yeah, there it is. Take care of it. Handle it, as you would say. Handle it.
Handle it. Handle it.
All right, Dad. I was thinking Martinsville. I've got a lot of fond memories of Martinsville. But before I get into mine, I'm just curious, when you think of Martinsville and your time racing there, what are the first things that come to mind?
The first thing, when I was a teenager racing dirt, we'd run Natural Bridge Speedway. We raced at 311 Speedway in Madison, North Carolina one time. We stopped by Martinsville. I don't know if I think it was when we were headed to the track. We stopped by the racetrack. This was, you know, nobody there. And I remember stopping and you go down to where you go to the little crossover gate going into turn. And they had that wooden fence. You couldn't see much, but you could peer in that little wooden fence and see inside the track. And I remember looking down that straightaway. And I remember telling my guys, I said, guys, if I could ever get the opportunity to race on this racetrack, my career will be complete. Because that was like our Daytona 500, you know, to do that when they did that Dogwood 500 deal with the modifieds and the late models. And now they've turned that back. And now it's come back to where the late model, the 300 lap race they do there. That's like all those guys, Daytona 500. Now I was so happy years ago when they started that deal again and did that. So that was, That was a great deal. So the first time I went there, is like, man, I have arrived. Blew the motor in the heat race, but I had arrived. It didn't matter.
Yeah, that's when I think back of going to Martinsville as a kid. I mean, obviously watching you races was at the top there, but one of the things I loved about going there was at that time you could stay and we get to see a late model race and we get to see a modified race. And that was literally the only time. Maybe you catch a late model race every now and then, but for me, that's the only time of year I ever got to see it's the only time in my life I've ever gotten to see the modifieds run was at Martinsville. And that's where I got to see, you know, Reggie Ruggiero and all those guys, Mike Stefanik, whoever run was at Martinsville. And that's one of the things I loved about going there. All right. Another thing I thought of, and this is literally one of my earliest memories in life. You won your first Busch Series race at Dover in, I think, September of 87, right? And I have a brief, faint memory of that. That's literally, I have one, my earliest life memory is 2 years before that when I was only just, a little over 2 years old. Our house flooded, and I have a little bit of a memory of after the house had flooded, I guess they had a dump truck there in the yard, and I remember there was just crap laying everywhere out in the yard. I remember getting to sit and ride in that dump truck. So that's technically my first memory. But my next memory.
That wasn't a good time, man. That water came up and went eight foot tall in that house, 8 foot deep in that house. Took everything in it and went out. Broke every window and door in that house. Took all but trophies.
Yeah.
Took a lot of stuff down the river, but we came out unscathed. We were lucky.
Yeah. The picture, you got some good pictures of that. We'll have to share those sometime. Those are pretty freaky pictures of the half the house just sticking out of this huge body of water. But anyways, my next memories in life that I recall are I just briefly remember the Dover win, and then I actually have some memories of the very next week you won your second race of your career. You won back to back. You won at Martinsville. And I remember, and I just recently for Christmas, I dug up some old VHS tapes of some of your wins in the Busch Series in the 80s, and I digitized them for you. And in watching those, this kind of came rushing back to me. At the beginning of that Martinsville race, you're being interviewed by, who's the pit reporter? Pat Patterson was the pit reporter, okay? And he was talking to you outside the truck while they were working on the car. They were pre-taping the interview to show it at the beginning of the race, talking about having broken through the week before getting your first win. And I was, let's see, I'd have been four years old. And I remember peering out of the truck, looking and seeing that they were getting ready to interview you. And Granddaddy was going to take me up to the stands where I was going to actually watch the race. But I remember making him wait because I wanted to wait for them to start interviewing you for TV, even though I was only four. I wanted to be able to walk through the camera shot. So even at four, I was a little fame whore is basically what I'm telling you here. And sure enough, if you go back and you know what? I ought to cut that replay. I'll cut that video up and put it out there here at some point. You just see little Ricky Mast with Granddaddy, RK, walking by in the background of you and you being interviewed by Pat Patterson. And that was by a four-year-old's design of wanting to be on TV and still trying to chase that kind of still being a fame whore all these years later, about 30 years later. So, but anyways, I also, the more fond memory is I actually remember you winning the race and being in I was gonna say Victory Lane, but it was that trailer they bring out there at the time that they brought out on the front stretch. When did they start giving out grandfather clocks to all the lower series for winning? You didn't get a grandfather clock.
I didn't get a grandfather clock. And I bitched the guys at Martinsville Speedway all the time about that. You know, I didn't get a clock. And their excuse to me now is, well, we never gave clocks away on Saturdays for the Saturday races. Well, sometime or another after that, they started doing it. It's same with Nashville. I went at Nashville one time, Ricky. They gave away these fancy guitars for years. And the one year that I won a Busch Grand National race, that one race, for some reason, they weren't giving a guitar away that night, you know? So there's no doubt in my mind that two of the things that I've been deprived of in my career was a damn grandfather clock at Martinsville and a guitar from Nashville. And I don't know, you know, I understand Nashville's point. I mean, Martinsville's point, you know, I think Mr. Earls, the way they told me the last time I bitched at him, which is about 3 weeks ago, they came up here and we cut some video together for a little series that Martinsville was doing. And I was bitching at them about not getting the clock. And the official stance is, well, you know, in those days, Rick, Mr. Earls didn't give away clocks on Saturday races. Well, you know, I don't know. I guess I've griped at them enough over the years where they've kind of drawn their heels in the sand and, you know, that's their standard answer. So, You know, but the guitar at Nashville, I never have gotten an excuse why I didn't get a guitar that night. Hell, everybody got guitars, yeah. And I didn't get it.
Well, but I will tell you, that is a giant trophy, though. That if nothing else, that trophy for Nashville. I know if it's the one sitting there in the house, that's a giant trophy. At least it's a huge trophy. It's the biggest trophy that's in the house, if I remember right. Yeah, at least there's that.
It's a nice trophy. But you know, that thing used to be a Ridgeway clock, and it was made in Ridgeway, but now it's made somewhere else. It's made Midwest or up north. I heard one of the drivers talking about it. I'm like, well, I didn't know that. But I tell you the saddest part of that deal that day when we won that race. It was cool to win the race, man. We kicked our ass that day, by the way. Car was awesome. But the race was over and I was doing my thing and the guys were pushing the car through the garage area. And of course, there's a companion race with the Cup guys. They said they stopped the car and getting ready to get inspected or whatnot. And Bud Moore, the famous Cup car owner, Bud Moore, he said he walks over and he looks at the boys, he looks at the car, walks around it, and he bends over and peers down inside and looks inside the car, and he looks up and he says, I tell you one thing, boys, y'all must have a hell of a driver because you got a piece of shit here for a race car. And he walked away. And my guys, you know, they went from being elated to winning to like, you know, what's the deal? And man, he downed our race car. Well, I told him, I said, guys, don't worry. One of the prettiest cars I ever saw. Hubert Hensley had a car at Martinsville one time. It was black, number 63, like he always did. Jimmy Hensley was driving it, and it was the beat upest, raggedest looking thing you'd ever seen. But that car led the whole race till I think Harry knocked him out or they got in the wreck at the end. And I remember thinking, man, that car looks good out front, even though it's ugly as hell. It looks good. And that's what I tried to do to get my guys built back up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you took home the trophy. That's about as pretty as it gets, right? Yeah.
It wasn't a clock, but it was a nice trophy.
All right, it's Rick's quote of the week. If you listened to the last MassCast, I got my first correct guess. I managed to guess who it was that gave this quote. So let's see if I can go make it two in a row here, like you did at Dover and Martinsville back in the day.
Yeah, you might do that. You might do this because you've probably heard this before. One of the funniest things I ever heard, and this comes from a driver during a race, and he calls into the crew. He says, "Boys, this motor wouldn't pull a grease string out of a hog's ass." End of quote.
Okay. All right. I have heard this now. Okay, let me go through. Let me talk through my possibilities in my head here. Okay. Right. Because there's, all right, Harry Gant comes to mind. Actually, Cale Yarborough comes to mind for some reason, but I don't think it was him. You know what? Now I'm going with my, always go with your gut instinct. If you don't know, just go with your gut instinct. I'm going Handsome Harry.
Yep, you're right. 2 weeks in a row, baby.
All right. There
two
we
weeks
go.
In a row.
I'm on a roll.
I'm gonna stop doing these easy ones for you. But that was the funniest thing. Harry, that was at Watkins Glen. And Harry was driving he was driving a skull car for Leo Jackson. Of course, I was driving a skull car for Leo's brother, Richard Jackson, at the time. And both those guys were pretty prideful people, especially Leo. He was, you know, Leo was a genius with engineering and machine work and stuff with metal. He was just a genius with stuff, and he was very prideful about his engines. He was an engine man, and you know, whatever was going on, and everybody in the sport knows Harry never had enough motor. You know, the motor's always a bubbling, and that's what we used to call it, no motor Harry, because the race would be over. How'd do, Harry? Yeah, car was handling all right, but old motor wouldn't run. That was his saying. Well, that particular day, I don't know what went on. But Harry said, he told, I think Petrie was a crew chief, Andy. He said, "Boys, this motor won't pull a grease string out of a hog's ass." Well, they said, the way I understand it, said Leo didn't do it, didn't say anything, but they looked at Leo, and he just took his headset, took it off, and spiked it on the ground, went and got Thelma. Thelma's Leo's wife, and got in a rental car and left the racetrack. And I don't think anything else was said about it after that. But that's just a quote that has to live in infamy. That quote has to be quoted and put out there for the racing journals of history, dude.
Yeah, it definitely does. And you said, all right, this is another Harry Gant term we can add to the lexicon. A bubbling. The motor was a bubbling.
Yeah, bubbling.
Define a bubbling.
A bubbling means the carburetor was flooding and the motor was not running clean and crisp and clear. You know, that just the bubbling smell. Harry'd always smell gas fumes. The old motor get the bubbling and smell the gas fumes, so it's not running right. But I think Schrader's the one said one time, said, well, no, Harry, if Harry ever dies, right on his headstone, it's going to be Harry, no motor Gant. That was going to be his thing. I'll tell you one thing, not having any motor, Harry won a lot of races.
Yeah, he'll be the first guy inducted in the NASCAR Hall of Fame that ran all those years without a motor, that's for sure.
Yeah, he will.
Thanks for listening to the MassCast, everybody. Make sure you rate and subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And more importantly, go out there this week and support your local short tracks. They need it. We'll see you next week on the MassCast.